Welcome to the Vietnamese podcast. Today I have Duan Quang Curtis. She's a documentary filmmaker and a dear friend. Thank you for coming back on the podcast today.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to talk about a few things. But first, congratulations on your Emmy win. This was awarded to you on May 28th, and this was for research for Turning Point, the Vietnam War.
Yes, documentary, research documentary. Yeah.
You know, I want to get started by asking you, how did you get asked on the project? And I think we did talk about this on a podcast episode a year before. But just to kind of, if anybody hasn't heard that podcast, just to kind of like refresh us and talk about the project.
So the project is a series, Netflix's series, Turning Point, the Vietnam War. Turning Point is a series of it's a docu-series. And there's been two before Turning Point, Vietnam War. But this one particularly was five episodes. About the Vietnam War and the impact of it, really. It's like a kind of going through points that, you know, weren't covered in a lot of other documentaries. Like there were secret recordings of the presidents that had been, you know, suppressed. Like they were released after the Ken Burns series. So there's things that, you know, that weren't known before in these. And we're also at a different time where you see the impact of the war and how it's affected, Americans' relationships with institutions. So, like the distrust of the government really came out, you know, during the Vietnam War with Nixon. There was, you know, people realized that they were being lied to. So, before it was, you know, kind of a more, you know, perceived as a more innocent time, even though it may not have been. People didn't know about Kennedy's affairs until later, things like that, because people would hide it. The media was better at hiding it. We have a very different media that we're living with now. And, before the Vietnam War, like with World War II and all the other wars before then, Korea, people didn't see those wars. Yeah. They weren't filmed. They weren't televised. They weren't even, you know, photographed so much. So people didn't really know what war was. So when, you know, I don't know if they thought it was like a football game, you know, with people on the field against each other.
Yeah.
But when, you know, the Americans came home with Vietnam, I think they knew how to use media as
right.
well.
It was the first war that was televised, right?
Yes. Yes. And, lots of propaganda used on all sides. You know, there was propaganda. The North, communist Vietnamese were just famous for their propaganda. They would use these acting troops and stuff that to do these performances that were technically illegal in there, but they would do it worldwide to kind of bring people into the cause. And then, you know, like the Southern Vietnamese, the Republic of Vietnam, they, you know, we still have film reels that they have of propaganda that were given to the Library of Congress.
Right.
And so, and America had its own propaganda, you know, so, and how they played with it. Like we have recordings of Kissinger talking about manipulating the world to feel like it was the fault of the South Vietnamese, you know, at the end of the war. He says literally like, well, we'll just start taking away funding and, Vietnam will be a backwater. That's what he said. No one will care. And those are from, you know, we have those recordings like in the series. And what's really cool is that, you know, a lot of people who are huge fans of Vietnam War films and study it said that they learned things from Turning Point Vietnam War that they didn't know. And I think a lot of it is, hearing those kinds of recordings and you know, people had ideas that they were being manipulated into thinking certain things, but they didn't know for sure. But hearing things that were secretly recorded or, you know, like the presidents recorded their conversations,
yeah.
like we have access to that now.
I have two questions for you.
Yeah.
First question is, how did you get invited to become a producer on the project? Like, how did they find you? What was the the process of that? And the second question is, like, if I was hiring you I would be thinking, okay, child of the South, right? South Vietnamese. Well, how would Duan affect the project as a daughter of the South when I'm trying to make a docuseries about the entire story?
Well, what I would say about being a daughter of the South is that's it's much more complicated than that. You know, my father was really a neutralist, and he just wanted a national independence for the Vietnamese. And, you know, with my first film, O Saigon, I go deeply into the story of my Uncle Hai, who it was a communist, and he fought in Dinh Binh Phu. He, you know, was fighting the French when he was a child, like at 14, 15. And then he got pushed up to the north and became part of the forces north. Of the north. And he and I were very close. And my younger uncle, who I actually found out more about him that he didn't tell me in O Saigon while making this project. So that was an interesting thing that I, you know, I thought he was more anti-war and neutralist, which he was to some extent.
Yeah.
But also he actively supported the National Liberation Front by giving them medicines. So for him, it was like a humanitarian act of helping people. He was just tired of war.
So all of that shapes who you are and how you contribute to the, because I'm, you know, because we sat through this before and I understand that you brought a lot of voice to the project, and the voice is not always, you know, the way I would think it would come from a child of the South.
I mean, I think, honestly, every journalist, every documentary filmmaker has a bias, of course.
Yeah.
Everybody is subjective. But you do your best to do the due diligence of following journalistic practices, you know, to question yourself and question, you know, you have these interview subjects, you choose them. And I've spent a lot of time in Vietnam. One of the organizations that helped me with receiving funding for my film was the Fund for Reconciliation and Development. So this was a New York-based nonprofit that worked, that came into Vietnam when the war was over, and they worked with trying to redevelop Vietnam and with Cuba. So they were trying to, you know, I guess normalize relationships between America and communist countries. And so I got a lot of exposure and help through them. I mean, we didn't see exactly eye to eye on a lot of, you know, there are a number of things that we didn't particularly agree with politically, but what I got was exposure. You know, I got to see victims of chemical poisoning. I got to, you know, meet a lot of anti-war protesters. And, you know, when I showed O Saigon to them in the, you know, 2000s, a lot of them just had no idea about the South. They were just so vehemently against the war and against the South. And they cheered when the South lost, you know, but they didn't really think about, like, what does a war actually mean? What does it mean on the population? Right. How does it affect people? You know, it is not a football game. You know, there's many more repercussions. And with my new film, we show that repercussions are more than 50 years with this war that still are strong and lasting for people who were survivors of these traumatic events that are part of war. So for me, you know, of course, I grew up as someone who was raised by the South and by anti-communist, but I went to, I was educated, you know, by a lot of professors and teachers who, and I got to really look at firsthand materials. That was the big thing. So, like, you know, I got the, you know, we were the victims of the war. That's what I grew up with. We should have won. It was, you know, America that abandoned us. We were right by being democratic. And then, you know, I get the American side was like the South lost and it was their fault. And then I get the, you know, the Vietnamese going back to Vietnam saying the Vietnamese, you know, the South were the bad guys and the American were the bad guys. So, you know, spending time in Vietnam and also looking at the direct research, looking at the events and studying history, that's what was it interested me. It's like, how did brothers go against each other in a war? How do people go against each other? So for me, like, how does family conflict and trauma happen and how, where did it come from and how does it affect us today? So that's always been my interest as a child, is like, I think I was looking for healing. And to me, I didn't see a communist and a Republican. I saw my dad and his brother.
Wow.
So, you know, so that, and they, and deep down, that's how they felt too, even though, you know, outwardly they said, you know, your dad was a traitor, or your, you know, like think these kind of things that they said, that were in my first film. And, so it's just really interesting to reconcile when there's the personal aspect of it. And Turning Point Vietnam War, the series that I worked on for, with Netflix, the director was, the son of an American soldier. Mm-hmm. So his bias, you know, and where he's coming from. And then we had a producer in Vietnam, Phuong Minh Gao, who was raised under communism and was taught, you know, like the very communist way that is suppressing other information being received from America and from the former self. So we all, that was important to me, is to have people represented on different sides.
Yeah.
Doing the research and doing the writing and talking through the story and, you know, bringing out different subjects that showed a part of the story. What I wished we had more of were neutralists. We did interview maybe one, but, you know, it wasn't used in the series. And, you know, so in a 5-part series, you don't really have a whole lot of time to even just tell the story straight, much less get into all aspects. And so, you know, there's some, you know, definitely things that were left out that can be, you know, touched upon more.
How did they find you?
So, Bo Kovitz, who was doing the research on the series originally, she was the first producer who was put on. She said to them, "You guys need Vietnamese people on this show." It's, you know, it was obvious to her, and they were like, "Oh, okay." So they went on a search to look for Vietnamese producers, and you know, because of things like access, language, you know, connections, all of those things. And being that I've been working on you know, different projects around Vietnam for, you know, 20 years, like since 1997 or so, 98, they said they found me through 3 different ways. And I think one was the podcast.
Wow.
And one was you know, through other producers who've heard of me. And they were looking at like films about Vietnam. So they watched my film. So, you know, like through, you know, different avenues, they came to me. And I guess, they decided to hire me because I had a lot of experience shooting in Vietnam. And, we also worked with Tommy Nguyen, who had experience shooting in Vietnam, and he focused a lot on, dealing with the censors and dealing with the government and, you know, our visas and hotels and all those kind of things. And, you know, we all did research on different subjects that we could bring to the story, and locations to shoot was more of Tommy's direction. But I had a lot of contacts through my time with the Fund for Reconciliation traveling. So I knew people from the TV networks of Vietnam, and they were incredibly helpful with finding me subjects who, you know, were considered national heroes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's one thing to talk to your uncle about his involvement with communism, but to be straight on with somebody who like bombed Americans or said they ran over bodies of South Vietnamese, like this one, you know, general that we interviewed, is kind of like, wow. You know, there was a way that my heart leapt when I was dealing with these people. There was like moments of fear that I had, but I had to just acknowledge like the war was 50 years ago, you know, and these people dealt with stuff much longer than that. You're safe, and you're a producer, and you're going to listen. And that's what you're going to do. You're going to open your ears and, you know, remember people's humanity. And so it was more, I mean, not so much a prejudice, but like kind of a lack of exposure. Yeah. You know, like when I first came to Vietnam and everyone called Ho Chi Minh Uncle Ho, Bac Ho, that was a shock to me at first. Like, what? You know, who's Uncle Ho? Like, and everyone was like, shh, you know, because I was like, Bac Ho Lai, And they're like, you know, so there were just ways that I wasn't raised. And then my cousin, she moved to America. She was like, oh my God, I was brainwashed in Vietnam. I had no idea of all kinds of things. And now she's a Trumper. You know? So, you know, it's like someone raised in Vietnam their whole life. It's interesting.
The docuseries, if the audience hasn't watched it, you need to watch it. There's some riveting moments in it. The one that stands out particularly for me, and I wanted to talk to you about that, is the one where I think she's a tanker, and she was young, and she was
tank killer.
Where she was shooting tanks.
Yes.
I'm guessing with the RPG or rocket-propelled grenade launcher that shoots in the tanks, and describing what an awesome feeling it was to kill Americans, right?
Or she actually just used a Robinet, like a crappy gun, in that firefight where she was a teenage girl, and she was with like two other teenagers, and they somehow got into a fight in outside of Kuchi, like with these Americans, and the Americans abandoned the tank. So it wasn't like she didn't destroy the tank or anything. She just managed to like somehow acquire a tank, you know. They still have it at the museum there.
Wow.
And you know, so yeah, she was a really interesting character. I talked about her a bit in the interview with you before.
The inclusion of that voice for me, or I can imagine for other children of the South, when you're first hearing it, it's shocking. But then you start to think about our parents' involvement in this whole thing. And I think the growth that I'm experiencing, you know, all these years getting to know you more, is understanding there's different sides to this story and really exposing this story, saying, you know, maybe we are the children of the South, but maybe there's like these other stories that are also valid and real and we don't share. That's not our story. But at the same time, coming to grips with it should be told.
Yes.
Just like the decision that you make to put her on a platform to kind of talk about the story.
Well, she wasn't my choice for sure, but she was one of my favorite interviewees because.
But not your choice?
Yeah. I mean, the Netflix executives were asking, can we get some female snipers? And that was kind of shocking to me because I was like, are they trying to show aspects of Full Metal Jacket, you know, to be true? Or we actually didn't find any snipers, but we found
her as
a bomber. You know, she made bombs by hand. She lost her arm. She was being beat up in a South Vietnamese jail, and she was a teenager. And she was doing some bad stuff, you know? She was killing and bombing and setting off bombs. They let her go, but they beat her. So there's like two things, right? It's like, okay, so they knew she was doing terrible things and they beat her and they broke her arm. And then they set her free when it started to gangrene. So there's like, you know, there's a lot of people who think she should have been executed or something like that, being, you know, caught doing these things. But she... Americans would capture her constantly. And she just had the funniest stories. She talked about once being taken on, you know, like this American guy, like called her baby-san or something. Mm-hmm. I don't know why they use these Japanese, you know, names in Vietnam.
Brought over from,
from
World War II. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, then he would give her candy and like blindfold her. And he said he was actually quite sweet to me. And so she talked about how, you know, the difference of treatment she would have where, you know, like one American guy took her flip-flops and like put them on the helicopter for her and like was really kind to her to keep her flip-flops as they're on a helicopter. And this other one comes on, just throws them out, you know, like immediately. So she just kind of laughed at like
the differences
in treatment from different people. And, you know, like I mentioned before, her story that She used to have a lot of empathy for Americans. She saw them crying in the night when she was a little girl. She like would climb up to like the encampments and just check them out. And, you know, she was like mesmerized, and she's like, they, she would say,
wow.
And she's like, she didn't know if they'd lost friends or they missed their girlfriend or their families, but she had empathy for them. But then she was orphaned because of, I don't remember exactly what, but I think her parents were killed by blast. You know, and then she was raised, who was going to raise her? But the NLF raised her. Yeah. So they used a lot of children, which is really, you know, messed up in many ways and effective. And, you know, like, but also at the same time, they were raising her. So this, it's so complicated. Like, what can you say about that? Mm. You know, they took in these children, but they used them in this way. And also, you know, it's very complicated. And also, like, the South Vietnamese, by beating her, like that is against international law. And, you know, and Vietnam was like a new republic. They were just forming their ideas of, you know, what does Vietnamese democracy look like? Mm. And, you know, I got to really look into that. And that was something I hadn't thought about, that it was a very new country and that they were still, you know, like you think of the Declaration of Independence and, you know, the Articles of the Constitution, how long that took for America. Vietnam was in the process of that. And, and, you know, and we're just getting there in the 70s. So it's something to, you know, I admired them for trying to, you know, because, and then they would make these methods of, you know, kind of like rigged elections and stuff like that at the same time. So it's like this attempt at democracy and then also like strongman politics, you know, at the same time. And, you know, how everybody has their way of doing government. Nobody's government is real democracy. Nobody's government is real communism. So it was interesting to see this interplay of a country, you know, fighting off their colonists and then trying to form with different ideas. And here we are, we're kind of we're not in a similar place because America's been established for 200 years, 250 years, but we're having those differences in how do we govern this country? Like, what is our ethos? While most people just want to live their lives, have food on the table, have enough to live and eat and take care of their children. And that's like most of the people and get from A to B and do what they need to do to earn money. And like that's what most people want. But then you've got these like kind of, to me, like high ideals on either end of like, you know, it's everyone should be equal. No, everyone should just get what they get, you know, yeah. Like.
Yes, that makes total sense now.
And I'm raised in America, so yeah. I understand the American point of view, too.
Yeah.
So it's like I've spent time in, you know, all the different countries. I lived abroad as well, so I know like European understanding of the Vietnam War, which is different from American, you know, being the less involvement directly in war criticism. So, you know, I think that's the thing about being a documentary filmmaker is that you do have to lay your bias aside. And what's great about it is the process of doing the work makes you less biased because you meet these people, you hear about their whole lives, you do very long interviews with them. I mean, you know, some interviews done have been like 4 hours or so. So you learn a lot about someone's life and you can't stop feeling their humanity. So I gained so much more empathy from doing the work, which is something I was looking for. I wanted to know, like, why. That was what drove me in the beginning. Why did my uncle fight against my father? You know, that was my first why in film. And another why in my work is all the way through from childhood. I wrote my first autobiography of the Vietnam War at age 9, and I did my first film at age 12. And it was also why. Why are we here? Why are we in this country? Why did we lose the war? Why is our home gone? Why am I separated from my sister? You know, like, why are my parents so unhappy? Like, those were my original whys. So, you know, why are we different than everybody here? Why do we think differently than everyone here? You know, so why do we look differently? There's just so many questions as a child going into it that, you know, some people, I think different Vietnamese people deal with the trauma differently. Like my younger sister, she's most concerned about safety. She's like, I want to have enough money so I can do everything. She's a child of refugees. She was born here and, you know, we were poor at first. And so she was more focused on that track, but I was more focused on how did this happen, yeah. You know? And my brother spent more time in Vietnam than I did. And my older sister spent more time in Vietnam. And I'm coming to understand how that time or lack of time in Vietnam is a real influence on each of our views of the war, of ourselves, of our relationships with each other. Like my brother is way more hierarchical than I am. He's a male Vietnamese. So he believes a lot in like, you know, you're the younger sister, you have to talk to me in this way. And my younger sister was born here, doesn't know that, you know? She's like, oh, whatever. She calls, you know, everybody's called by their first name. She doesn't give anybody more respect for being older. And I'm in between them.
Yeah.
This episode is brought to you by Red Boat Fish Sauce. Some things will never be replicated by AI. The fragrance of fish sauce hitting a hot pan, the sound of your grandmother's voice telling a story only she knows, the feeling of a family recipe passed down through generations that are imperfect, alive, and completely real. Red Boat Fish Sauce has been a proud sponsor of the Vietnamese podcast for years because, like us, they believe in authenticity you can taste. And together, we're bringing you the Viet Story Bank, a recording service built on that same belief. Your stories matter. Your family's memories, your lived experiences, your history. These deserve to be preserved exactly as they are. Untouched, unfiltered, they're human. So don't wait for the right moment. Learn more about the Viet Story Bank through the link in our show notes and pick up a bottle of fish sauce at HMart, 99 Ranch, or redboatfishsauce.com.
I want to switch over to this whole statuette here. Not a whole lot of Vietnamese people win these things, and not a whole lot of Vietnamese women win the Emmy or an Oscar or a Tony. Did you see this coming? And how has it affected your life? It's been almost 2 months now.
Yeah, well, first I will say that I was looking into it to see, you know, what Vietnamese American filmmakers have won Oscars and Emmys. And our friend Tom Cross was the first Vietnamese to win an Oscar, first Vietnamese by descent, Vietnamese American to win an Oscar. And I saw that there was one Vietnamese woman, I unfortunately can't remember her name at the moment, who won an Emmy, a daytime Emmy for costume. So that's the one Vietnamese I know who's won an Emmy before. So.
And there's a news anchor, Lino Nguyen.
Are you talking about like national Emmy or like?
Well, I don't even know what that even
means. Oh yeah,
means.
Because there's like different kinds of Emmys. So there's like, the statuettes even look different. So like this, you know, you see some of them and they're smaller.
Yeah.
Those are like they have local news Emmys and they have like LA has like,
their own Emmys.
Yeah, like California has its own Emmys. Yeah, every state has its own Emmy.
I should know this.
Yeah. So there's the primetime Emmys, when the daytime Emmys, there's the news and doc Emmys, which is what, you know, I'm one in. And so they're all and those are like the big trophy, the national, you know, Emmys for like national productions and stuff like that. And then you have all the local ones. So there's some people say that they've won Emmys, but they actually won like local Emmys. And those are easier to win, which I wish I'd known before when I made Osaka, because I would have tried and done some sort of local thing. But there's many ways that people play the game too, like I met a woman this week. I was at a documentary film conference, and she talked about how she had a program on Netflix that won a daytime Emmy for series. I was like, how is that a daytime Emmy if it's on Netflix? Because that's not particularly
24-hour, yeah.
Because it was like health related, so it was seen as a subject that they deal with in daytime. And someone else I met said that he didn't have a chance to win like best documentary. So he got into best sports documentary category because you can apply for different ones. And Turning Point Vietnam War actually got nominated for Best Documentary, which is very rare for a series. Usually it's just a single film. Unfortunately, we didn't win that one. And Best Historical Documentary, I was in those categories. And then there was Research Documentary. And we were also nominated for Lighting and Sound, which were, you know, individual to those players on our team.
Yep. So there's like levels to this. I mean, it's not like the Oscars or the Tonys, right? I mean, Emmys have like different levels.
Well, there's student Oscars. So you have that student academy.
Phil Bannon, one of our friends, won the student. He's a friend of Tom Cross.
Yeah.
Won a student. He's also Vietnamese, not Vietnamese, won the student. So it's a totally different category.
Yeah, there's also tech Academy Awards, and they look different. So I have a friend who's won two Oscars, but they're in a totally different ceremony. The statuette looks different. It's like a smaller Oscar with like kind of a book to the side or something.
So yeah.
Like a plaque. So there's different ones, but this is like the statue. You know, the national statue. So I've seen the local ones before.
It's heavy as heck. I've seen Instagram posts where you were in the subway with this. Can you tell me about that? It seems like a New York thing to do.
Yeah. Well, the funny thing is, I guess Netflix, you know, that with all the streamers that are in the world, like, you know, when we were young, there were, you know, 3 or 4 channels. And so all the money went into all those programs. But now there are so many streamers, so many channels, YouTube, all this stuff. And Netflix they used to cover flights and hotels and cars for people when they were nominated for Emmys and Oscars and things like that and awards. But they just don't have the budget. There's so many programs that they have. And we were told, what I understood was that we had a one-way cab ride. And it turned out it wasn't true. I took a $72 cab ride into Manhattan from Brooklyn, staying with my friend, filmmaker Sam Coleman, who's also an Emmy winner, an Oscar nominee. And it wasn't paid for. So on the way home, we looked at how much the Uber was going to be. And, you know, it was a lot. It was, you know, like $80 or something like that. So we're like, okay, we're taking the subway. And we were on the subway. And part of me, you know, this, we had a carry bag for it. This is the case. It's huge. And, you know, we're carrying it in this bag that's specifically made for it. You see how this thing fits into this, and it's like velvet. And, you know, when part of me wanted to, like, you know, because New Yorkers are so fun, you can just like say like, hey, and a lot of people, when I told them, hey, I won an Emmy, everyone's like, oh my God, it's so cool. Like, LA people are a little bit like more like dazed about it. Like, you know, like, oh, whatever, you know, but, I wanted to tell people, but it's like New York City at night. It could be dodgy. And I wouldn't be like, hey, I want an Emmy. And so I was like, thank you. Thanks for your Emmy. So, and then at the end, I thought, well, I'll do it right before I get off the train. And by the time we got to Brooklyn, I mean, it was super late. We'd gone to an after party at the Mandarin Oriental, and everyone was passed out. So there were like two like guys sleeping. And I was kind of like, okay, bye.
That sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah. But what was incredibly cute was I did a shoot in DC just at like right after, like 2 days after, and I met up with my mother-in-law. My husband was with me, and we were meeting up at a restaurant, and she said, where's the Emmy? I was like, oh, it's in the car. And she said, can I see it? So I thought, okay. So I went to the car, got it. And next thing you know, the waitress was like, can I get my picture taken with you? Can I hold the Emmy? And so like the whole restaurant, next thing you know, everyone's like, hey, come over here. It was incredibly sweet. It was kind of like, I didn't realize how exciting an Emmy is for everyone.
Yeah.
You know, that it's not just the person who wins it, but it's just kind of like a special thing that not everybody... You know, like, I've had people grabbed and started waving and, like, putting their fist in the air, like, thank you, like, you know, doing the whole time when.
You know, there's a significance for me sitting here talking to you because I used to be in the window coverings business for 25 years, and I would do bespoke homes for all the stars in LA, and there's Grammys and Oscars and Emmys on everybody's shelves and Tonys. And I remember that experience saying, like, I'm so close to these people, but I'm not. Like, you can't talk to them. I'm like physically close to them, but you're not able, but I consider you a friend. And I'm able, this is the first time I've been able to touch. And I mean, I've seen them in so many of the homes that I've done.
Yeah.
And it is really an honor and a privilege to be able to sit here with you as a winner. I'll hold it again.
I'm gonna take your picture because I love taking everyone's picture with it because it's just so cute. Like, because it doesn't feel like it's just mine, you know?
Mm.
And another part of that was when we got nominated for the 5 Emmys, I texted the Marines from the Fall of Saigon organization that I met a year ago at the 50th anniversary of the Fall of Saigon, which is part of my current film that I'm working on, Oh America, 1975. And they really took to it, and they were so excited for me. We're on a thread together, and one of the wives said, "What are you going to wear?" And I was like, "I don't know." And next thing you know, all the Marines are like, "You should wear an Alia." Like, they knew what it was called. They'd been stationed in Vietnam before. And then a couple took me aside and said, "We want to buy your Alia for you." And I was so incredibly moved. I couldn't believe it. They're like, "We're just going to contribute to your dress and your trip. Do whatever you want with the money." And next thing you know, they Venmo'd me money. And I went down to Little Saigon to my friend Drang's shop. She has a called Tan Drang. And I took all these fabrics and different dresses and sent them pictures, all the Marines. And they all, there was one I particularly wanted, and it was maroon and gold. And they all loved that one. And didn't think about the fact that maroon and gold is the color of the Marines. Dress color, right?
Yeah.
Flag. And so I just sent them a picture of a Marine shirt back at them. Coincidence, like the colors scheme. And you know, they're like, "What are the chances of that?" It was just really cute. And then they heard that my husband wasn't going to the Emmys because a ticket is $700.
Yeah.
And so they sent us, all got together and sent us money. They crowdfunded without in one afternoon. So I was about to leave the next day, and next thing you know, they sent enough money for a plane ticket and a ticket to the Emmys, and my husband, and I just managed to get him on the same flight as me and ran some, other producers on a plane with me. It was a really special experience, and they were watching the whole time live and just texting me, and I was just texting them in the audience. It was just so much fun, and you could just see how excited they were for me, and it was just a really beautiful experience to have them with me. It's like they took me out of Vietnam and they took me to the Emmys, you know.
Well, there is a reason why I think that they did that for you.
Yes.
You know, you've affected my life in ways that, I mean, you've introduced me to so many guests, you know, in the early years, and you didn't even know me. Like, you didn't even know who I was. And as I'm sitting here touching the Emmy, I remember you actually gave me the job to translate from Vietnamese to English in this docuseries. So thank you so much for that too. You've touched a lot of our lives, and I'm a U.S. Marine, was a U.S. Marine too. So, you know, we have a lot to thank you for, and you've really touched a lot of our lives. And it's not just me. I know it's a lot of us in this business. So thank you.
Thank you. So it means a lot when, you know, because you do the thing that you need to and you feel is right, or you know, the universe is tapping on your shoulder and saying, hey, you know, or you got the questions in your heart.
Yeah.
You do what you believe in, but you don't realize that so much of it is energetic connection, you know, that, you know, you meet people that you're supposed to meet, you connect with people you're supposed to connect with. And then I hear from younger filmmakers how my work influenced theirs. Like, you know, a playwright named Vivi Tai said that when she saw my film, she was inspired to make a one-woman show about her family's escape. And she did that at the Hollywood LA Film Fringe Fest. And it got really great reviews. It was a great play. And, you know, that's amazing that you just be you.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you do that every single day with this podcast. You introduce so many people to all different sectors where Vietnamese people are working and inspiring. I know my nieces listen to the program, watch it, and, you know, that affects a whole nother generation. So, you know, it is amazing through like all of our connections and all of our, all of the things we do for, we kind of do for ourselves, we affect everyone in it. And so, you know, we don't exist in vacuums.
No, we don't. You don't. What's your next project?
Oh, I just want to show too that this was the dress that I wore at the Fall of Saigon, and I took it with me during my Emmy speech. And it was like part of the speech was about the dresses, and the whole audience, you could hear them just go like, oh, like when I said, this is the dress I wore during the Fall of Saigon, you know, because I was that tiny.
You're holding the Emmy in one hand, probably fucking yes. The other. Like,
yes, like this. And so my next project is Oh America 1975, and it's about 50 years later, the Fall of Saigon. This is my third and hopefully final Fall of Saigon film. I started this project, as you might remember, my brother and my cousin, who were 4 and 6 during the Fall of Saigon. They were airliftees in the planes and helicopters, and they knew what was going on. And there's, another Vietnamese American who famously was photographed on the, with the yellow flag and the three stripes atop the Capitol. Mm. He was also an airliftee from the Fall of Saigon. And they all were at the Capitol on January 6th during whatever some people call an insurrection, plus some people call it a rally, you know. You know, my brother had a very different description of it than what I, you know, saw on the news. So, but that is what started me on that project. And then when I was interviewing people for, like I filmed Viet Thanh Nguyen and Lang at his wife Lang at your house. And there's another guy named Nick Wing, who was also part of the airlift. He was on the very same ship as me, the Hancock, and his father was one of the people who, the helicopter pilots who landed in the ocean, you know. He was 3, we were all 3 and 4, so we were just, none of us remember the Fall of Saigon, like little moments of it, you know, but none of us clearly remember the way my brother and cousin do. They have like what you call explicit memory. We had implicit memory, which was like the feelings that you get, that I remember the feelings, but not the actual things. Even though I remember implicit stuff before and after that week, I don't remember anything. And so interestingly, all of us replay the Fall of Saigon over and over in our work, like in The Sympathizer, he's in the Fall of Saigon. And it's like he's replaying, Viet is replaying something that he had forgotten. And, like all of us touch on so much on Vietnam in our work. So I found that really fascinating. And then when I met the Marines of the Fall of Saigon, they, you know, a number of them were like, you know, obsessed, like Vietnam War filmed with films. And a lot of them, just carried the same sort of PTSD as me. And, you know, there's this thing of with the Marines of like, no one's left behind. Right. You don't leave anyone behind. And yet they left 400 people on the roof of the embassy. And that guilt brought like 10% of them to commit suicide. You know,
I didn't know that's a high number.
Yeah.
But it's weird because it's ingrained in you as a Marine. It's like two things, mission accomplishment and then, you know, leave no one behind or troop welfare. Right.
Yeah.
And so it's like encoded in us the entire time that you're training to become a Marine and while you're in the fleet, that's what you're genetically like programmed to think about. And so when you leave and evacuate and you leave people back, it's, I can't imagine.
And the last two American soldiers who were killed were not collected for a year. They were in a hospital, like an Adventist hospital in Saigon. They left them behind, you know? And so they, and even though it wasn't their fault, they were like, most of them were 18 years old at the time.
Yeah.
You know, and I went to the funeral recently of Juan Valdez, who was called Top Valdez. He was the very last Marine to get on the very last helicopter to leave at the fall of Saigon. So he was the very last American in the war on Vietnamese soil. And, you know, he was Latino. Like, there's not a whole lot of acknowledgement of that. You know, the very first prisoner of war was Latino as well. There's all of these. And that's what I liked about Turning Point Vietnam War is the way we have people like that in our series. We had, you know, Black soldiers, Asian American soldiers, people who were Japanese who were, you know, drafted. And so it's the kind of representation that is not the ones that keep being done over and over again that I really enjoy seeing. So I wanted to show an aspect. You know, also there's, you know, like CIA agents in my film and, you know, people were part of organizing the airlift and the effect on them 50 years later and the effects on their loved ones, too, because war doesn't end just with one's experience. You know, you can't help but affect the people in, you know, if you're wanting to commit suicide, you know, or, you know, which I think many people who survived from the fall of Saigon felt. There was a lot of, you know, like I had a number of attempts in my family, including myself. Like I didn't understand it as a four-year-old child. I would go to the night drawer and want to stab myself. And it wasn't my fault that my older sister was left behind, but there was this like grief that like can't be contained in a lot of ways to witness the chaos like that and the pain of people being in danger in such a way, people dying, like people getting hurt, people getting trampled on and fighting for their lives to get out and not being able to. And, you know, I think witnessing the falling apart of a, you know, one's country like that and the entering of, the losing your home, really, that was hard for everyone to witness, except for the winners. And even the winners, I noticed, like when we interviewed a lady who had been a spy, when she talks about the fall of Saigon, she says she feels both grief and victory, you know, like that feeling of like so much pain, all you're holding back and holding in, even though she, you know, her side won, just the grief of everyone who was lost. And, you know, I think about how it has an effect, a long-term effect for everyone. She died, unfortunately, after filming. All I have of her is that interview.
Yeah.
But how incredibly special it was to get to meet the other side who and see that it wasn't easy for them either.
Yeah.
You know, it was a very painful road for everyone involved, which is what wars are.
You know, All America sounds very complex because now it's like shifting different perspectives within your own family, your perspective. When does it come out?
Well, I'm still working on it.
Okay.
And I'm trying to fund the editing of it right now. I've had some people offer, so hopefully that'll come through. But, we've still been shooting. And it's just been a beautiful process of getting to know how other people lived after the war and how long it affected them. And I think, you know, as a filmmaker, I don't think I intended to heal myself in the process of making the film. I didn't know that that's what I was trying to do underneath it all. You know, I just thought, well, I'm just curious. I want to know how to do this. I think it's important. This hasn't been covered. This point of view hasn't been covered. So there was the journalist side of me. And then this, but what I didn't realize is that being with these people who suffered in many ways, in different ways, in similar ways to me, has made me really feel
healed.
Yeah.
Healing.
And loved and connected in this way that I have never been. So that was an after effect that I didn't expect.
Yeah. I and beginning to understand that this obsession that we have, you have your obsession with this part of history. I have an obsession with the migratory sort of development of Vietnamese people globally. This is a gaping hole that we have, these wounds that we have, these core wounds that we have that we can't explain. But the obsession, it involves healing. And for me, it's podcasting, it's writing. Parts of me have that filmmaking side, and now recently painting. All of these things are just to really settle my soul about not being born in Vietnam. I look at my brother and I get so angry. I'm like, you got to be born in Vietnam and I didn't. And then he's been living there for 24 years and I never got that chance. And it's nobody's fault. I mean, you know, he didn't want that. You know, he just, and I always wanted it and it just never happened. But I'm here for another reason too in America. You know, there's things that I have to work on to really work on this obsession too. And it's not like, like, if I'd moved to Vietnam, I'd be able to fix this. I'm fixing it and healing it just the same way that you're doing it, making movies and, you know, answering to the call of the wild with this obsession.
I luckily got to interview you for the film, even though you weren't even born yet.
Yeah.
You still feel the trauma that your parents carried from it.
Absolutely. So I understand that implicit, explicit perspective when you were talking about it right now.
And for you, you weren't even alive yet. And yet you carry this weight of what your family went through, you know?
And this anger of like, you know, why am I not part of that tribe? I'm like FOMO, lifetime of a FOMO existing human being who's just constantly going like, but when I recognize you, I hear you, I see you, because I just, you know, like it's kin, you know, it's a kinship that we share with this obsession.
But maybe that FOMO that you had is what led you here and makes you serve a very specific purpose that maybe someone else wouldn't have, because you have such a hunger to understand Vietnam that you're asking these questions of everyone, you know, several times a week. So you need that kind of, you know, like, and if I hadn't been traumatized and, you know, had family disconnected in the war through, you know, my sister being left behind, my uncle being on the other side, all those things, maybe I wouldn't have the need to like hear all the sides, you know? So it's like maybe the trauma is the setup for what the universe asks each of us.
And the payoff is we spend time setting it up, but the payoff really is the healing.
Yeah.
And it completes the cycle of woundedness. And I'm like, I'm here for it now. Like I used to be so unhappy with this feeling, but now I mean, with the help of ChatGPT, it really opened up my eyes.
Really?
Because I started to like say, why am I like dragged into this, that painting and all like writing? I'm obsessed with this. And it's just one subject. It's all the Vietnamese.
Yeah.
And then ChatGPT is like, okay, well here, let me break it down. It's not the medium that's important.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, and I was saying to Phil that I wanted to do a painting series, you know, like afterwards. I also would like to do a comedy, you know, and just switch into other things.
Totally.
But there's so many ways to express. I mean, you know, it's
we talked about the stand-up comedy. Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
I'm like, why am I like pulled that way? But yeah.
But there is so much that's funny that you know you need to release. Everyone needs to laugh about this. Yeah. You know, that's why we just die laughing when there's like, you know, like those Vietnamese videos on Vietnamese parents that we all recognize. We're like, oh my God, yes, that is my parent.
It's the same everywhere. I look forward to having you back on in a few short months. I mean, you know, once you're done with it and it starts to tour with the film festivals and all that, we'll have you back and we'll catch up. But I mean, obviously we go to dinner quite often, so I look forward to that as well.
Thanks, Ken.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trin. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.